Welcome to the 11KBW podcast on consultation beyond Moseley by Andrew Sharland. This talk was given at the 11KBW Local Authority Conference on the 1st of October 2015. For more podcasts and information, please visit 11kbw.com.
Good morning, everyone. In the next half an hour or so, I'm going to talk about the law of consultation. Prior to the judgment of the Supreme Court in Moseley, approximately a year ago, developments in consultation had occurred incrementally in a large part as a result of judgments of the Court of Appeal. Not much had happened since the Coughlin judgment 10 years ago. The circumstances in which a public body is required to consult are now well established and helpfully set out at paragraph 98 in the Richard III judgment, which I refer to and set out in paragraph 2 of my paper. Moseley represents the first occasion on which the Supreme Court has considered the requirements of consultation in the public law context. On a first reading of this judgment, it might appear that it represents a fundamental shift in relation to the legal requirements of consultation. However, now that the dust has settled a little, and we've had quite a few judgments from the first instance courts, but also from the Court of Appeal, it appears that suggestions of a radical change may perhaps be misplaced. It's therefore necessary to consider the judgment in Moseley in some detail before looking at the subsequent cases to establish where we are now. Moseley concerned a consultation exercise by Haringey Council in relation to its proposed council tax reduction scheme. Following central government's decision to abolish council tax benefit, local authorities were required to adopt a local scheme to provide financial assistance to those who had previously received council tax benefit. There was a statutory duty to consult prior to adopting such a scheme, and local authorities basically had two options. They could either adopt a scheme which provided financial assistance at the same level as council tax benefit, or adopt a scheme, and if they adopted that approach, they'd have to make up the shortfall from other funds because central government funds were not sufficient to maintain the level, or alternatively, adopt a council tax reduction scheme which provided for a lower level of support than the benefit, in which case the recipients of the benefit would have to make up the shortfall themselves. Haringey, like a large number of councils, opted for the second option and they consulted on their proposed scheme. Notably, the consultation did not refer to alternative options that had been considered but rejected. The Supreme Court upheld the challenge and held that the consultation exercise was unfair because, one, the consultation document had not referred to alternative options and why they had been rejected, and two, the consultation document itself was positively misleading in suggesting that the council had no other option but to pass the shortfall on to recipients of the benefit. Now, there are three main judgments in the Moseley case. The lead judgment is perhaps given by Lord Wilson, with whom Lord Carr agreed. The second substantial judgment is given by Lord Reed, who says that he was generally in agreement with Lord Wilson, but notes that he would prefer to express his analysis of the relevant law in a way which lays less emphasis upon the common law duty to act fairly and more upon the statutory context and purpose of the particular consultation. And thirdly, a very short judgment from Lady Hale and Lord Clark, who helpfully agreed with both Lord Wilson and Lord Reed's judgments and stated that there, quote, appears to be very little between them, although they do expressly endorse Lord Reed's approach in their three or four sentence judgment. The statement by Lady Hale and Lord Clark that there is very little difference between the two judgments is perhaps susceptible to debate. That is a debate that has been occurring in subsequent cases, and I think will continue to occur. For example, on one reading, it appears difficult to reconcile the view adopted by Lord Wilson at paragraph 39 of the judgment that consulting about a proposal inevitably involves inviting and considering views about possible alternatives, with the statement of Lord Reed at paragraph 40 that the duty to consult does not inevitably require information on the giving about alternative options. Perhaps more fundamentally, the judgments of Lord Wilson and Lord Reed highlight a wider divergence of views in relation to the concept of procedural fairness. Lord Wilson's analysis is very much grounded in the concept of procedural fairness, the common law concept of natural justice. Namely, that irrespective of how the duty to consult has been generated, i.e. whether by statute or common law, the common law duty of procedural fairness will inform the manner in which the consultation should be conducted. Ultimately, the question for Lord Wilson is, was the consultation fair? Somewhat Protean concept. By contrast, Lord Reed proceeds on the basis that the case was not concerned with the common law duty of procedural fairness, and he states at paragraph 37 that the present case is not, in my opinion, concerned with the circumstances in which a duty of fairness is owed, and the problem with the consultation is not that it was unfair, as that term is normally used in administrative law. Lord Reed expressed the view that a wide-ranging consultation in respect of a local authority's powers, in respect of local finance, is far removed from situations where the common law has recognised a duty of procedural fairness. And the purpose of the consultation in that context was not to ensure procedural fairness, but to ensure public participation, which he regarded as a different aim. Therefore, whilst the Supreme Court unanimously agreed that Haringey's consultation exercise was unlawful, arguably a 3-2 majority of the court favoured an approach which focused on the particular statutory context rather than demands of the common law on procedural fairness. When I talk about the three in the majority, that's Lord Reed and Lady Hale and Lord Clark, who expressly agree with him. Despite the differences in approach, there is a large amount of agreement in the judgments on the substance, and six key points emerge from them, which are set out at paragraph 14 of my paper. The first key point is consultation has three main purposes. Firstly, it leads to better decisions. Secondly, it avoids a sense of injustice. Perhaps those of you who've been involved in local authority consultations may perhaps doubt how much the sense of injustice is dissipated by consultations, but that's what Lord Wilson thought. And thirdly, it reflects a democratic principle. Importantly, the Supreme Court endorsed what are known as the Gunning principles, or sometimes the Sedley principles, which are set out at paragraph 3 of my paper. They're very well known, but they've now been endorsed by the Supreme Court. The first such principle is that consultation must be undertaken at a time where the relevant proposal is at a formative stage. Secondly, sufficient reasons must be given for the particular proposals to elicit an intelligent consideration and an intelligent response. Thirdly, consultees must be given an adequate time to respond to the consultation. And fourthly, the product of consultation must be consciously considered and taken into account by the decision maker before finalising any proposals. The third key point coming out of the Moseley judgment is the degree and specificity and detail that must be provided to consultees will depend on the identity of the consultees. Where you have a central government consultation of local authorities, the degree of detail is likely to be less than where a local authority is consulting vulnerable individuals, for example. More might be required where the consultation relates to the deprivation of an existing benefit rather than the conferral of some future benefit. fourth important principle is sometimes fairness will require consultation not just on the preferred option, but on discarded alternative options. The word sometimes there is important. It's not exactly the clearest word to... it doesn't give a huge amount of guidance on when such consultation will be required, but I'm going to return to that shortly. Fifth principle, even where consultation on other options is not required, the public authority may be required to inform consultees of other options and why they were rejected. And finally, on the facts, the court held that the consultation document was misleading in suggesting that there were no other options. It should have included, the court held, a brief reference to alternative options and why they had been rejected. However, notwithstanding these areas of agreement, a number of questions remain unanswered by the Supreme Court's judgments in Moseley. Two obvious questions arise from these judgments. Firstly, when will fairness require a public authority to consult on alternative options? Lord Wilson's answer is sometimes, and particularly where the statute does not limit the consultation to preferred scheme. Secondly, the uncertainty arising from the lack of clarity on this point is compounded by the decision of the Court of Appeal in Roussel against London Metal Exchange, a commercial judicial review case, which took a different approach. In a judgment which was handed down after the hearing in Moseley, but before the judgment in Moseley, the court in the Roussel case, Court of Appeal, referred to exceptional cases where the courts have held that consultation process was unfair by reason of the failure to set out alternative options. Now, it was thought by a lot of commentators that in light of the Moseley judgment, the Supreme Court would give permission to appeal in the Roussel case because there was a real tension between the Moseley judgment and the Court of Appeal's judgment in Roussel. But the Supreme Court refused permission, thus creating further uncertainty, perhaps. Secondly, when does information about other options have to be given to consultees? Lord Reed held that the duty does not invariably require the provision of information about options which have been rejected. The question for him is whether, in the particular context, the provision of such information is necessary in order for consultees to express meaningful views on the proposal. Lord Wilson adopted a different approach, namely whether fairness requires it. When Moseley was first handed down, it was these points that were thought to have the most practical significance. The common understanding prior to Moseley was that public bodies were rarely required to consult on anything other than the preferred option. And secondly, Moseley was thought to potentially widen the obligation and thus broaden the scope of consultation challenges so that the claimant could argue that particular options should have formed part of the consultation. A further unexpected feature of the Moseley judgment was the willingness of the Supreme Court to scrutinise the consultation documents in forensic detail. The judgment refers to the use of the indefinite article, the size of the font, and the use of bold. Now, that approach was somewhat surprising. It's definitely not the approach that the Court of Appeal and the Administrative Court had adopted previously, but there it was. And I understand that Clive, who acted for Haringey in that case, had quite a fun time discussing the punctuation and the font of his client's consultation document. As the dust has settled since the judgment in Moseley, subsequent case law appears to have dampened fears that Moseley represents a sea change in approach. I'm going to deal with five such cases. Broadly speaking, the approach of the court to date has been generally to, one, distinguish Moseley on the facts by reference to the fact that the consultation document in Moseley was said to be positively misleading. Secondly, to reaffirm the orthodox position as it stood prior to Moseley, that there was no general requirement to consult on alternative options. And thirdly, to emphasise that Moseley largely restates the principles that have been commonly understood for some time. First judgment I want to talk about is the Thomas judgment. This concerned a challenge to a decision to cease provision of inpatient beds at a hospital on the basis, amongst other things, of a breach of statutory duty to consult. Hickenbottom J focused on Lord Reed's judgment rather than Lord Wilson's judgment. There was a statutory duty to consult in this case, and he thought Lord Reed's judgment was the most helpful. Hickenbottom J held that whether the duty arises in a particular case, and if it does, the scope of its requirements will depend upon the statutory context. That echoes very much Lord Reed's focus on statute rather than Lord Wilson's approach focusing on fairness and the common law. And the learned judge also held that the courts would be slow to add to the burden of consultation which the relevant democratically elected or otherwise democratically accountable body has decided to impose. Where there is a statutory obligation to consult, the demands of that consultation exercise will principally be informed by the statutory scheme. If, for example, the statutory scheme incorporates various other checks and balances, for example, monitoring by a third party, the demands of consultation may well be less rigorous. Second case I want to deal with is the case of Robson against Salford City Council. The first instance judgment in Robson was handed down before Moseley. Permission to appeal was given in light of the Moseley judgment, but the Court of Appeal concluded that Moseley didn't change things that much. There's quite a detailed analysis of the Moseley judgment in Lord Justice Richard's speech. The Robson case concerned a challenge to the council's decision to close its passenger transport unit and provide alternative transport arrangements for disabled adults on the basis that the consultation was unlawful. In particular, it was argued that the council's proposal was misleading. Lord Justice Richards observed that the decision in Moseley is largely an endorsement of principles already established by the Court of Appeal, but provides an application of those principles, thus suggesting Moseley did not mark any fundamental change. Richards interpreted Moseley as being a case where the consultation was procedurally unfair because the consultation document gave a misleading impression by failing to mention other ways of absorbing the shortfall, limiting Moseley to where the consultation document is positively misleading. On the facts, Lord Justice Richard said it was difficult to decide whether the consultation document in that case was misleading, whether it presented an incomplete picture. However, ultimately, he decided that was too formalistic an analysis, and the judge had been right to conclude that the consultation process was not unfair. Lord Justice Richards distinguished Moseley on the basis that the document was not positively misleading in relation to other options, nor was it wrong to place reliance on consultees' assumed knowledge of the position. And I believe the claimant in Robson sought permission to go to the Supreme Court, and that was declined. Peter acted for Salford in that case. The third case I want to touch on is LP and Warwickshire, yet another case that those sitting to the right of me on the panel acted. James was for successful counsel Warwickshire in that case. This was a judgment of Mr. Justice Mostyn, who I think is somewhat of a maverick. I think that's perhaps the politest way of phrasing it.
Very sound fellow.
So I generally treat his judgments with a degree of caution. The issue of significance in this decision, the court said, was whether the test adopted by Lord Justice Sullivan in a decision called Baird against the Environmental Agency, which was whether the consultation will only be unfair as to be unlawful where something had gone, quote, clearly and radically wrong. That was a phrase articulated by Lord Justice Sullivan in the Baird case and a number of other cases, and there was an argument about whether that remained the correct test in post-Moseley. Mr. Justice Mostyn concluded that it did remain the relevant approach, and he concluded that nothing in the judgments of Lord Wilson and Lord Reid undermined that. Ultimately, the judge was reinforced in his view by reference to remarks of Lord Justice Richards in the Robson case. I think the clearly and radically wrong test is, from a public authority perspective, a very attractive test, and therefore something, if you're acting for a local authority, something you're going to invoke. I'm not clear that it necessarily encapsulates the correct approach, even pre-Moseley, but you do have the judgment of Lord Justice Mostyn in support of that proposition. The fourth case I want to deal with is T and Trafford Metropolitan Borough Council. This was a challenge to the consultation around cuts to adult local adult social care budget. Mr. Justice Stewart proceeded on the basis that Lord Wilson's judgment had supported the majority. He highlighted the fact that Lord Wilson said that sometimes fairness requires consultation on discarded options, and identified three important issues to consider when deciding whether fairness actually requires consultation on discarded options. Firstly, whether the duty to consult was a statutory duty, where the duty requires consultees to be given an outline of realistic alternatives. Secondly, the purpose of the consultation. Consultation on discarded alternatives more likely to be required where the purpose of the duty is to ensure public participation. And thirdly, the nature of the issue being consulted upon. It seems to suggest that a single issue case was more susceptible to consultation on alternatives where compared to consultation on a wide range of issues. On the facts, the court held in that case that there was no requirement to consult on arguable but discarded alternatives. Fifth and final case I'm going to discuss is the Morris case, another of James's victories in front of Mrs. Justice Patterson. She rejected a submission that Moseley established that alternatives must be consulted on. She said that sometimes fairness may require it to be the case so that consultees can make sense of the consultation exercise. When that is the case, the alternatives will have to be realistic alternatives. What is realistic will always depend on the particular circumstances of the consultation being carried out. On the facts, she attached weight to the matter that other financial options have been consulted in a previous consultation. She pointed out that overloading a consultation with options might confuse consultees, and on those facts it was sufficient to consult on the do-nothing option as an alternative to the proposals. The claimant in the Morris case sought permission from the Court of Appeal, and that was refused. So where does that leave us? Well, all five cases on consultation that have gone to court post the judgment in Moseley have all been unsuccessful. I think that's a very important point to note. It appears the lower courts are pushing back against Moseley, or at least the original interpretation of Moseley by a lot of commentators. Moseley's largely been distinguished on its facts, understood as consolidating rather than amending previously understood principles relating to consultation. Whether, as a matter of analysis, that approach to Moseley is justified remains open to debate. We definitely haven't heard the last of this. However, it does seem to me that Moseley has had at least two practical changes in the way in which consultation issues are now being dealt with by lawyers. Firstly, the high degree of scrutiny of the consultation document in Moseley is something that is now playing out in the cases that are being argued before the lower courts. The courts are now taking a more active role in looking in a detailed fashion at consultation documents. Nervousness around the implications of Moseley has led, I understand, to a significant increase in the extent to which advice is being sought from lawyers on consultation documents at an early stage in order to head off potential challenges. Secondly, the lack of clarity arising from Moseley has in many cases prompted public authorities to embark on a more extensive consultation exercise than they might have done prior to Moseley. In order to reduce the risk of a successful challenge to consultation documents, many public bodies would be well advised to include a short explanation in the consultation document summarising the options that were considered and the reasons for rejecting those options. As Lord Wilson pointed out in Moseley, such a requirement is not necessarily particularly burdensome. It merely contemplates brief reference to other options. It's clear that the ramifications of Moseley are still being worked out, although, as I mentioned, it's notable no challenge post-Moseley has succeeded. I don't feel the courts have fully grappled with the inconsistencies in the judgments of Lord Reed and Lord Wilson. What we seem to have ended up with is an adoption of Lord Reed in the context of statutory consultation, for example, the Thomas case, and Lord Wilson where the common law applies, for example, the Tea case. It seems unlikely that Moseley will be the first and last time the Supreme Court is called upon to consider the consultation obligation. Whilst the judgment of Lord Justice Richards in Robson seems to have firmly closed the lid, for now at least, on the suggestion that Moseley marks a fundamental shift in the nature of obligations imposed on public bodies in respect to consultation, I'm confident that this is not the end of the matter. Thank you very much.